Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and we are celebrating our sixth year on the air, if you can believe that. September 7th of 2013, we went on the air September 7th of 2007, and it is not very often. Maybe it only happens every 6 years or so, that the same date and day coincide, and that's what's happening today. And we come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also broadcast on a2zen.fm on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific time, so if you'd like to catch the program then again or for the first time. And you can also listen to the programs at any time by going to richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We archive the programs where you can listen to any and all of the past 6 years' programs as we bring them to you each week. And we encourage you to go to the websites of our guests and check out their information as well. Today is a rather interesting program. Not only is it the sixth anniversary, but it is also a program that I think is going to be interesting to talk with our guest about, because it's dealing with Greek mythology. It's dealing with a particular, I believe he's referred to as a titan, a god, if you will, and his name is Prometheus, and he epitomizes the concepts, if you will, in regards to new paradigms, in regards to our past and our present and our potential future, if we're going to have one, and two paradigms in particular. And we're going to talk with a gentleman who I met through one of our other radio programs, Will Lynn. And Will, I want to welcome you to Tell Me Your Story. It was an extraordinary conversation that we had initially, both on the air, talking about a period of time that I love, the medieval days, searching for the Ark of the Covenant, although some would say that's under that category, but the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about Prometheus. He is considered a god in Greek mythology.
He's a titan, yet he's the only titan to have fought on the side of the Olympians against the titans in the original war between the titans and Olympians. And I would say that the titans are referred to as gods, yet there's kind of a delineation between the titans and sometimes the Olympians are referred to in short as gods.
Okay, so let's clear up one thing. Let's clear up one thing first. That what we're going to talk about in terms of the Greek mythology has little to do with the movies that are out, Clash of the Titans and the Part 2 and Part 3 and Part 4. Where you're not going to learn much about Greek mythology through these. You may hear the names of the gods, Zeus and Zoroaster and some of the others, but it's not going to teach you much.
Agreed.
So we're going to
talk zip it on that.
Okay, very good. So we're going to talk about Prometheus, who, as I was doing some reading, he helped us to understand, and maybe even in the context of the mythology, bring about the first paradigm shift of humankind.
I think so. There are kind of two sides of it. One, he's the character that's credited for creating human beings out of clay, and then also for giving them or waking up their minds. And so, in a way, he kind of creates, is the father of humanity. But he also is the one to bring them knowledge, and in the form of the fire, and basically enable us to do everything that we've done since, knowledge, art, but not just knowledge and art. As was the Genesis story of Eden, his actions are responsible for life as we know it: birth, death, work, marriage, children, suffering, knowledge, and more specifically to the Prometheus myth, art, science, and technology.
Okay, and with every myth, I've heard this phrase, there is some truth.
I think so.
That these myths are not born out of some vacuum, somebody just telling a story on a campfire. They came about as some kinds of experiences that the people must have had with, and I'm going to just put it this way, with otherworldly beings. And somehow these stories have been translated down through the centuries. We have the mythology of the Greek mythology. And that's just one form of mythology. There's many other cultures that have the same kind of mythology. which begs the question from your mm-hmm. perspective, do you see otherworldly influence?
Yeah, well, I would argue that no story would be so enduring as the Prometheus myth if there wasn't something more coming through, if there wasn't something really, really, really important to us humans. And I think that for me, from an academic point of view, I remain a little agnostic as to whether or not what is so profound that's coming through is coming from the depths of the human soul, something we're also not very familiar with sometimes,
right?
Or from the depths of creation and divinity. And it could be both. And I'd say that I'm very interested in the archetypal approach. And so it comes from Jung and James Hillman's workings with these common recurring structures in thought, structures in behavior, structures in image, all these kind of recurring tones and feelings and ideas. And I think that these over time have become extremely charged for human engagement. So Prometheus is an archetype. Actually, one of my favorite books on Prometheus is called Prometheus, the Archetypal Image of Human Existence by Carl Carinier. And he's looking at Prometheus as a representative, as a symbol of humanity itself. And actually, Dr. Richard Tarnas points out, quote, "In the ancient mysteries, man had been symbolized as the great mythic figure of Prometheus." And so Prometheus, in a lot of ways, symbolizes us.
So in terms of our understanding who we are better,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to delve more into this, how important is it for us to know and understand these myths, this mythology that exists both from the Greek and other cultures?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I would say that normally we don't necessarily tap deep enough into ourselves to know what all we have down there and to be all that we can be. We're not normally, unless we really work on it, we're not normally working with all that we have to offer. And I think that these mythologies, these myths, they so explore the different sides of human life. And even though they're about the divine often and about gods, they're, I think, one of the main things they're doing is exploring human life, human qualities. And so these different gods, which, and I think it's really important to differentiate the monotheistic structure that we've inherited in this culture and the polytheistic structure of, say, for example, the Greek mythology. And so the monotheistic structure will tends to inspire the psyche to want to center everything around some kind of ultimate, you know, various ultimates. Whereas a polytheistic mythology points towards the extreme diversity of these various numinous energies of the different gods. And so from a polytheistic mythological perspective, it can inspire the mind to engage its multiple different characters. I can appreciate my inner Zeus authority figure. I can appreciate my inner Prometheus spark. I can appreciate even my Venus if I and on the right day. So whereas a monotheistic tradition doesn't normally stretch you necessarily into the various characters that a polytheistic tradition will.
And again, I'm learning new words and new terminology here today especially, but monotheistic is a single deity.
Absolutely.
Such as the Christian tradition, although even uh-huh. that is a little contradictory because they talk about the three aspects of
absolutely.
The one God. And a polytheistic, obviously, is multiple gods,
mm-hmm.
such as Hinduism
mm-hmm.
in
yeah.
particular.
And I think there's something fun going on because there is a certain, as you point out, a polytheism implicit in monotheism where, you know, you also have the saints and you have all the and that's actually why Catholicism, one of the reasons Catholicism was so able to move into various indigenous cultures where they were worshiping multiple gods, that because the saint system offered a sort of polytheistic form.
Right.
And then similarly, you can look at the polytheism of Hinduism, for example, and you can kind of see a monotheistic reduction to, for example, everything is Brahma's dream,
mm-hmm.
Or in Brahma's head and Vishnu's dream. And there are kind of ways to spin a monotheistic interpretation of even polytheistic right. structures. They're kind of implied in each other.
Now, some folks might be wondering, where are you from in the sense of why am I having you on this program? Well, our conversation was very interesting, and you are actually working on a dissertation or a thesis?
A dissertation.
A dissertation. Mm-hmm. The difference between that and a thesis?
Sometimes words are interchangeable, but okay. a dissertation is very specifically for a PhD, whereas a thesis can sometimes imply a master's thesis.
And you're working on your PhD in?
In the program's mythology with an emphasis in depth psychology, so kind of where the myth meets the mind.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And where?
At Pacifica Graduate Institute in Carpinteria, California.
Okay. And what is it about, obviously the psychology as well, but what is it about mythology that intrigues you so?
You know, I didn't take a mythology class until my senior year in college. didn't have a clue it'd be that interesting. I mean, I'd always been a little bit interested and seemed to have a certain memory for it, but philosophy was my primary interest. The questions of, you know, who we are, what we're doing, all these things. And so throughout my undergrad, I dealt with these questions the way I knew how, you know, religion, psychology, and most specifically philosophy. But it wasn't until after I graduated that I read a book of Joseph Campbell's, and it became very clear to me that the most profound stories throughout history are dealing with these same questions. You know, who are we? What's our purpose, etc. But in a completely different way than I had been dealing with them in philosophy, in a complementary way, as I saw it. And so I saw an opportunity to work on the things that I've been working on, but from the other side of my brain, from a different language than logic, mm-hmm. from a language of symbolism and narrative metaphors. And so that's why I'm so interested in mythology, because I see it as a complement to the standard philosophical approach to the big questions.
Unfortunately, I say this in somewhat jest of myself, that I consider myself to be somewhat sort of culturally challenged, you know, theatrically, cinematically, book learning, but also in terms of the classics, in terms of reading many of the classics, and many of them have to do with Greek mythology, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know that Greek mythology has influenced people down through the centuries.
It's part of our tradition.
And it's like, well, why Greek mythology? Why not one of the other? Why not Egyptian mythology or Asian, Chinese mythology and so on and so forth?
That's a fabulous question. I'm actually really intrigued by that as well. And I think it's partially because for whatever reason, and there are several, I believe, Westerners didn't start identifying with the history until the Greeks. So in the West, I don't think anybody in the United States identifies with the Egyptians or identifies with the Babylonians, whereas Western civilization, moving from the Greeks to the Romans to eventually the Christianization of Rome and then Christian Europe, United States, etc., it all goes back through a kind of narrative to the very beginning of recorded history. Now, there is definitely historical recordings of other civilizations from Egypt and Babylon, etc. But we, in this kind of special way, start our identification with the Greeks. And part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that the Greeks we credit for knowledge and reason and order more than we should, perhaps. But it's something we identify with. We identify with knowledge and order and these kinds
right.
of things and civilization. And so it has a lot to do with our identification and the success of conquerors. They were conquerors, part of the conqueror's lineage.
It is said, too, that the Greeks invented democracy,
mm-hmm.
yet the founding fathers did not establish a democratic system, at least in the context that I hear it from historians of American history,
mm-hmm.
they established a republic,
right.
which is different from a democracy.
Right.
And yet we give them credit for establishing democracy, that is the Greeks, as though it were some great thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not criticizing democracy.
Right.
I'm just saying that it's like we've almost deified the Greeks,
yes,
as they have done with the mythological gods.
I love that point because I really think that there's a difference between a story and a myth. And a myth has a certain type of charge to it and an importance to it. It's not just a story to us. And I would argue that human history, that whatever history you identify with, mm-hmm. is charged to you in a similar way that a myth is.
Yeah.
And so I think that part of the history of Greeks starting democracy, et cetera, this is a charged story for us. It's virtually part of our mythos.
Okay. A friend of mine and I, back in the late 80s, early 90s, big Trekkies, uh-huh. loved the second Next Generation series, like
Love
the first
it.
One too. But the Next Generation series, we began to converse about these different episodes and the things that happened. And he made an interesting comment I'll have you also comment on. He said, from his perspective, that the Star Trek stories mm-hmm. were our modern mythology.
Yeah, that's compelling. I would argue, though, I would mention that's also been said about Star Wars.
Okay.
And it's also been said by Neil Gaiman, for example, about Marvel and DC Comics, mm-hmm. The American Gods.
Right.
So I think there are a few stories that are kind of vying for that kind of centrality, but multiple stories have a real potency to them. When you have people dressing up and showing up hours to wait in line, it's more than a story. People are participating in that story, and that is
something
mythic.
Really resonates with them.
Absolutely,
and they want to be a part of that.
Absolutely, and I think that's what how great, if not myths, great almost near mythic literature. For example, Milton's Paradise Lost. I think these kinds of stories, or Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, these stories take off because they hit such a resonant center in the collective, or at least a large enough portion of it.
I want to get back to Prometheus in a mm-hmm. few minutes here, but to me this is somewhat fascinating because, you know, you start going down the list of the various things, and then the next thing that comes to mind is, at least in America, although it does seem to be in other countries as well, sports.
Oh, yeah.
And sports figures.
Oh, yeah.
And if there isn't a vicarious living through the players on the mm-hmm. field or on the court, wherever mm-hmm. it is, I love baseball.
And I love to
watch it. There are people who criticize it for being so slow. You know, it's one of the few games, along with golf, that has no clock.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it gets criticized for that. But if you are a lover of the game, it doesn't matter how fast or slow it is, because your mind is working between mm-hmm. pitches and between innings, saying, all right, what are we going to do now?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an anticipation sport. And if the more you know about it, the more you realize that between each play, there's actually not enough time to think through all the things you want to think through between each pitch.
There are not.
And so the game's moving plenty quick for me.
Well, and then, of course, I'm hearing terms each season that we broadcast games on this station.
Mm-hmm.
I hear terms that it's like, I don't understand those terms. I know what's going on, but then, of course, basically the color guy is doing some analyzing of, mm-hmm. okay, well, they could do this or this or this
yeah.
or this. And it's like those terms or there was one that came to mind. Now it's not there. But anyway, we live through these players,
uh-huh.
especially uh-huh. The ones who really make a name for themselves. One that comes to mind in my time frame is a man who was with the Yankees. They called him Mr. October, Reggie Jackson.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I mean, the things that he did on the field were so spectacular.
A few homers in a World Series game.
Yeah, exactly. But they live in our minds mm-hmm. as – but they're not myths right now.
But they're carried with the potency. And they're retold. Retold. I love the movie Basketball has this interplay with him. So – great stories get retold.
The mixture of basketball and baseball. Interesting movie.
What was the great line from some movie? I don't even remember if it was a great movie, but I think it was a great story deserves embellishing.
Yeah, I think I've heard that before. I love getting my hands on and watching the various baseball movies.
Uh-huh.
I haven't seen the one yet with Brad Pitt. But it's supposed to
Moneyball.
Be pretty good. Moneyball.
Uh-huh.
Because they do something that I wish every team would do. what I miss about baseball in particular, since we're on the subject, I miss the loyalty of the players, but it isn't the players' fault that they aren't loyal to a team. It's the managers and the team owners that force the players to move from team to better their advantage going into postseason.
And looking at the way that that influences the fan base is actually of a lot of relevance. So, like, I was actually in – I was in Newcastle and went to see a Newcastle game, and I talked with this man there. He was basically saying the same thing about soccer, but then it occurred to us that the riots and the fighting that used to take place over soccer or football matches does not take place anymore because there's not this homeristic, nationalistic attitude. And in some ways, that actually – the fact that we do this the capitalistic approach to the game actually expresses our collective psyche in a lot of ways. A lot of fans are like it because they're committed to capitalism too. And capitalism is part of the game and part of how the modern mind works. And I think that that's part of how a mythos can be almost invisible to a culture.
But you and I, we could toss up different names of different players in baseball and say, oh, yeah, he's a Dodger. With this team or that team or the other.
That's rare.
Because that's
nowadays
who we remember was with that team, but not today. You throw up a name today, if I could remember any of them, you don't know what team they're with even today.
Yeah, I think Chipper Jones and Derek Jeter are the only examples of a generation, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Oral Hershiser, Dodger, the Dodger. And I can't remember the guy's name, first name now, Gibson. I called him Gimpy Gibson because he was the one who hit. It was, strangely enough, it wasn't in the last game, but it was in the first game of that World Series that year, where it was the classic setup. Ninth, bottom of the ninth, two outs, full count, 3-2, and he hits a home run to win that game, which then gave them the momentum in the preceding games to go on and win the series. And he hobbled around that diamond. And it was watching him, and it was like, you know, when I think about that, it's like, wow, that's – but it's a sport.
Well, let me cherry
these
pick
guys.
That.
Yes, go ahead.
So that moment, bottom of the ninth, two outs, you know, we can all say it in slightly different ways. That is very charged. And so in the Prometheus myth – eventually, he'll tell Hercules how to get the golden apple. And the golden apple is something that we could think of in a similar way. Hitting a home run in the World Series has this very similar emotional feel, the success, one of the ultimate successes, you know? That's what achieving the golden apple would have felt like, but a different mythic language. But still, our culture, when you start saying bottom of the ninth, everybody's voice changes in the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it's
add the drama.
Totally. So I'd say that's a potent expression of something that modern expression of the kind of energy that we find scattered throughout myths.
Before we continue, I want to let our listeners know we're talking with Will Lynn, who is a pre-PhD candidate, I guess you might say, working on your dissertation regarding mythology. We're talking about Prometheus, one of the Greek gods in Greek mythology. And when we come back from our break, what I'd like to do is let's start from the beginning. Once upon a time, and let's tell the story and then also talk about, we've already discussed briefly the first paradigm of Prometheus.
Entry into human life as we know it.
We're going to talk also about the second paradigm, which we'll get into. I'm Richard Hoogan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we are going to be right back in just a moment.
Tell me your stories.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and joining me in studio, which is really kind of nice to have a guest in studio, is Will Lynn, and he is working on his dissertation. What would we say, on Greek mythology?
I'm looking at the three common origin stories of knowledge in the West. So Adam and Eve, Prometheus, and the story we always tell about philosophy starting with the Greeks. And then I'm looking at a particular meta-narrative within those three stories that I better save for another time.
Okay, that's good. Well, the reason why Prometheus was rather striking for both of us in our conversation before was because of the program that we do here, Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And Prometheus, in the narrative, brings about the world in which we are living today, if you will, civilization as we know it. But let's go back to the very beginning. Once upon a time, there was Prometheus, or words to that effect.
Here's the story. So Prometheus creates humans. This is the earliest story. Prometheus creates humans out of clay and then brings them to life. And by the way, the sequential chronology of a myth is not always the same way that real history works, just as a quick disclaimer. So he's creating humans out of clay, responsible for the human race. And then he decides to help Zeus overthrow the Titans. And when he does so, or after doing so, Zeus decides, I'm now the new ruler, and I would like to start everything afresh. I'm going to wipe out all of the world and all of humanity and start rebuilding. Prometheus is very upset with this and defends humanity by telling Deucalion and Pyrrha to hide in a barrel or a boat or a trunk or an ark, if you like. And then everything, Zeus kind of takes it okay, and the gods and the humans are getting along just fine. And then there's a dispute in a place called Mekone. And to resolve the dispute, Prometheus decides that he's going to give an offering from humans to gods as an appeasement. And so he's going to split this oxen in half. And he splits it in half, and he gives all the meat on one side and all the bones on the other. The idea is that he's going to trick Zeus into taking the bones by putting all the delicious fat on top of them and by putting all the meat beneath the stomach, which is the most disgusting thing to eat, apparently. And so Zeus is not fooled by this offering. However, he goes with it anyway, but immediately takes fire back from humans. And so Prometheus, of course, immediately goes and appeals to Athena for help, according to some stories, and steals the fire from the Olympians, sometimes from the hearth, Hestia's hearth, sometimes from the wheel of the chariot, and sometimes from the forge of Hephaestus. With this fire that he brings to humanity, he brings them all the arts, all of the. Let's see, I think I've got it. I've got a good. Let's see, yeah, right here. Metallurgy, medicine, pottery, writing, mathematics, astronomy, navigation, architecture, farming, and the harnessed horse. So Zeus is, of course, livid that he was defied this way, much like Jehovah was livid when Adam took Adam and Eve took what they weren't supposed to take, and knowledge.
Ironically symbolized as the apple.
The apple, right.
By most people. Although I've read enough translations of the Bible to know it never specifies the fruit.
Right, it's just a fruit.
Yeah.
But interestingly, in Greek, the word for fruit and the word for apple is the same.
Oh.
Like something, I can't pronounce it, but melon, M-E-L-O-N, with some accent marks in there. So Zeus decides he needs to really punish Prometheus and humanity for this. And so what he does is for Prometheus, the famous punishment is to chain him to a stone in the Caucasus Mountains where the sun rises. And he also tries to, he sends Hermes to ask Prometheus about a prophecy about how Zeus's fall will come about. And Prometheus refuses to give him that answer. And because he refuses, Zeus sends an eagle that symbolizes both him and the sun. And the eagle eats at Prometheus' liver all day, every day. And which heals at night. To punish humans, he gives them Pandora. And this is where the setup really comes in. This is where humanity becomes humanity. Because before, in the story, there are just men. And so by giving Pandora, you are now giving a couple. There's now a woman. And a lot gets displaced. A lot of the angst and anger gets displaced onto the woman. But it's also the scenario of there being a couple, because the couple will now become married. There'll be the first marriage between Epimetheus, Prometheus' brother, whose name means hindsight. Prometheus' name means foresight. So there'll be the first marriage. They'll have the first child, and he'll now have to work for food to sustain his family, to sustain the wife and child. And also, because knowledge of the gods has been withheld, it's extra hard and really a pain. So Pandora then opens a jar, mistranslated centuries ago as a box, and upon doing so, all the ailments of the world, all the plagues and awful, awful things, hunger, famine, all enter into the world. And the one thing that doesn't quite make it out of the jar is hope, which leaves the question, is hope something awful or is it something good? And I think that there are two interpretations, two views. I think Hesiod sees it as is almost negative, something like Silenus, though the Silenus was a satyr, the teacher of Dionysus, and Silenus, his wisdom is that, you know, poor humans for being born. It's awful to be a human. Best thing you can do is die quick. You know, and so Hesiod takes this kind of point of view that human life is suffering, you know, thanks to this fall. Whereas Aeschylus, when he talks about the story in his tragedies, he shows mortality is a beautiful thing. And he encourages humans to react to mortality with art and science, also given by Prometheus. And so Prometheus, so you got humanity working and toiling and coming into civilization with knowledge, and you got Prometheus chained to the stone. And this is symbolizing life as it was known to the Greeks. But then 13 generations later, just like there are 13 cycles in the moon, it's actually the offspring of the moon, Io, will be Hercules 13 generations later. And Hercules, as Prometheus knows and prophesies to Io, Heracles to the Greeks, will come and save Prometheus, set him free. And that story is really unique because he uses the firebrand that Prometheus gave to humanity to sear the heads of the Hydra closed, to cauterize them off so that the Hydra didn't keep splitting heads. And with the blood that he took from the Hydra, he poisons his arrow. And with that poisoned arrow, he kills the eagle. So the blood of the Hydra is hugely responsible for saving Prometheus. And to get the blood of the Hydra, he had to use the firebrand that was given by Prometheus. So once he sets Prometheus free, unchains him, Prometheus immediately tells him how to get to the golden apples. He tells him you cannot get it yourself. You need to ask a god to do it. So Heracles will ask Atlas, and eventually he'll get the golden apples. There's another story in there with Chiron, the teacher of the heroes, a centaur, taking the place of Prometheus, but that's a probably unnecessary addition to the story.
Now, the aspect of bringing about the civilization to man was through the fire, which obviously fire can be used for many things, not only melting down of the ores that they would find in the rocks into metals, steel and iron and so forth, but also in terms of light in order to be able to learn to write and read and do all of those different things. So you had those two specific
and
items.
That's why Prometheus is chained to the sunrise. He's not just the fire bringer. He is the light bringer,
right?
The reason bringer, the illumination bringer. He is the spark, the first beginning of this fire where the sun rises.
The thought just occurred to me, is there any correlation between the Greek gods in terms of the mythology and the signs of the zodiac?
There are, and some people take that really far. I'm not extremely familiar with it, and it became especially popular for the Romans as they would rename the Greek gods. For example, Aphrodite would become Venus. Venus is the planet, and so I'm not sure how important astrology was to the Greeks, but it definitely became very important to the Romans, and the Romans became very interested in the relationship between the gods and the planets and their influence on us.
It seems to me that knowing these things, maybe that's better posed as a question, of what relevance is knowing? And this kind of goes back to, I think, a question I asked earlier as well. Greek mythology or any other mythology. What relevance? I mean, we're here now and we're dealing with what we're dealing with. So if I knew of the Greek gods and what they did or didn't do and so forth, how does that help me and or civilization?
Okay, so Prometheus is the god of technology among many, many other things. And technology is something that we are dealing with right now and have been for a long time. However, technology is now getting to a point where its power is, we're getting to the point where we may be able to make ourselves immortal, for example, clones, all these incredibly, you know, sketchy things.
Yeah.
So Prometheus, part of the reason why he's restrained, according to some scholars, is that you need to restrain technology. You need to say there is a limit to technology.
It begs the so this then goes to the very question that I am now posing every time I see these news stories about what we can do
mm-hmm.
with the technology that we. As a matter of fact, I saw a promo just the other day. I think it was on the wormhole with now I can't remember the gentleman's name. Anyway, that says that you know we're going to be able to create a baby from two men or two women.
Uh-huh.
We're even going to be able to make hybrids or maybe even combine the DNA of both a human and animal. Of
uh-huh.
course, they showed the image of a spider. And I'm thinking, okay, so what attributes of a spider are those that we would want? But again, it goes to the question that I am now using regularly, and that is, just because we can, does that mean we should?
That's such an important question. Well, Prometheus, he's a character through which the ancients considered technology.
Mm-hmm.
So the considerations and the wisdom surrounding technology is in many ways expressed in Prometheus, in the myth of Prometheus. And so the people that worship Prometheus most, his followers, were known as the Cabiroi. For the Cabiroi who were the craftsmen of ancient Greece, Prometheus was very important. He was their progenitor. And so when they were initiated, they would wear a band of iron around their ring, a ring with a stone on it. And it's very important because the story continues to the point where Prometheus is unchained. Because now we are losing the limitations of science. We now can do all kinds of stuff. So the reason they wear the ring is to remember restraint, even though they are unbound. And that is something, if I could get a ring on a ring with a stone of iron, an iron ring with a stone on all the fingers of all the technological, the scientists pushing our technological limits right now, mm-hmm. I think that would be a very good thing. It's very important that the technologists in ancient Greece wore that ring. And I think it would be a good thing to learn from that myth that continuing to wear the ring, continuing to remember restraint and why it was there after we move past restraint is maybe one of the most important things for humanity to do right now.
Now, the transformation from an uncivilized to a civilized people
mm-hmm.
is credited to Prometheus primarily because of fire.
Mm-hmm.
However, we're starting to shift away from a civilized people. And we have been for probably maybe some would even say centuries, if not thousands of years. But primarily here we are in the 21st century, and there are times when I look around, I'm going, what the heck? What are we doing? How is it that we're doing this again and again? And which is one of the reasons why, you know, a lot of people, they don't want to watch the news because, as I've theorized, all of the stories that you'll read in the paper or see on television or hear on the radio – they've happened over and over again,
mm-hmm.
thousands, if not millions of times
mm-hmm.
down through history. The only difference is the dates, the names of the people, and the locations. But it's you know, put it up there in one category, man's inhumanity to man.
So just as we should know our history so that it doesn't repeat, we should know our myths because in our myths we have considered very deep and powerful and potent things. And if we know our myths, it's much like knowing our history. It's knowing the wisdom that has been important to us before.
Mm.
So that as we move to new times, we don't forget the wisdom that was so important in old times.
And so that I think that would bring us to the next phase, and that would be the next paradigm
uh-huh.
shift. And there's an element within the story that is symbolic
mm-hmm.
in regards to this paradigm.
Yeah, so Prometheus first gives humans fire, but then he will, through Hercules, give humans the golden apple. And so as we were talking about in the context of the World Series, the golden apple is symbolic of ultimate achievement. It's like golden, what golden means, it is something to be golden, and then the apple is the fruit. So the fruit is fruition.
Mm-hmm.
So it is like the ultimate fruition.
Right.
And because Prometheus is a representative of humanity— and Hercules is an archetypal representative of humanity, you know, the hero representing the hero in all of us. it's almost as though there is a process going on from the development of the initial spark of fire, the beginning of technology, to its ultimate achievement in the golden apple. And I would argue that we have pushed technology to some of its ultimate achievements. But to come with the achievement of the golden apple, it only comes after Prometheus is unbound. And he's unchained from the stone. And what my interpretation of this is that this symbolizes him being unchained from the thought process, the paradigm of materialism. And so now, for example, some of the most incredible technology we have is sitting right here next to me is this iPhone, this Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And it is only working this way because it is completely dematerialized. It is of zero material value. Its value is in its relationships. And it only connects to everything because of immaterial waves. And it connects to the internet. Everything it does, when I look at an image, I'm not looking at a real person. I'm looking at a dematerialized representation.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm hearing something, it's a dematerialized representation coming from somebody. So the dematerialization for digital images, the dematerialization in thought process required for Wi-Fi and cell phones, the modern technologies so rely on dematerialization that you can look at the transcendence or the liberation of Prometheus, this symbolic representative technology, his liberation from the stone, you can almost see it as a foreshadowing of the eventual human liberation, scientific liberation from the materialistic paradigm. And that's so important because science was driven by the paradigm of materialism for its entire history, it seems, especially its topical history, the history that we are willing to tell as opposed to the astrological and alchemical things we brush under the rug. But
right. But
the history we tell of science is fundamentally materialistic. It peaks out in the Enlightenment perfect paradigm of materialism that we get with Newton, but then is undermined again for the first time, finally, by Einstein, who not only says that things don't reduce to matter, they reduce to energy, but he's also the first, and he won the Nobel Prize for the idea of the photoelectric effect. And that the photoelectric effect brings the mathematics of a wave into the understanding of an atom. And that's something I think is very important, but that should perhaps be put on hold for a moment. But what is really important is that he is introducing a dematerialized science. Einstein begins the dematerialization of science, and technology has been dematerializing ever since. And so as with Prometheus, finally free from materialism, finally able to achieve the golden apples, the ultimate achievements, and eventually Hercules, because of it, will achieve immortality, so too are we at that moment, where technology is unchained from materialism and it is achieving some of its most incredible successes.
And yet there would also be those who would argue that technology is again, going back to that question, just because we can, should we? Because there are people who are now, they're saying it louder and louder and louder,
mm-hmm.
that when you have one of these electromagnetic devices near your electromagnetic device, i.e. you.
Brain, heart, yeah.
You are interfering with those fields, and mm-hmm. you are causing the potential for greater dis-ease.
Dissonance.
And so forth.
Yeah.
And then who knows what it's doing as far as reconfiguring the brain waves in terms of your attitude towards things, towards people. It seems as though that more and more people are connected, as they say. I mean, mm-hmm. we heard about the Arab Spring,
yeah.
a year or so ago, and they were tweeting and they were Facebooking and they were doing all this stuff to let people know what was going on, which was a great thing. I'm not mm-hmm. criticizing mm-hmm. that, but the fact was that you also had a lot of violence in the streets.
Yeah, that also is very Promethean. He's the leader of rebellions, and so Prometheus, as the leader of rebellions, he is the character, he is the image, the person to be calling on for these rebellious movements. Well, from the language of Greek mythology, at least.
I find it very interesting as we continue talking here about Prometheus and about Greek mythology. that if I had known this story when I read a book, and I know that I read it because it was one of these thick paperback science fiction books written by Frank Herbert, who wrote the Dune trilogies, which I also loved. But he wrote a book called, and I've been looking everywhere for it, and I have not found it. And maybe I have it stashed away in my locker and under the house. The Prometheus Project.
Ah, yeah.
Now, I thought, boy, if I had known this story then even more of what was being said by Frank Herbert would have made even more sense to me in that context. And I'll use a specific case in point is a comedian by the name of Dennis Miller, who in his comedy, which he doesn't do much anymore, but when he was in his heyday as a comedian, I used to say, oh, yeah, I like Dennis Miller because he uses obscure historical references. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're only obscure to me because I don't know them. And so it's one of those things where when he uses them, unless I choose to go look up that reference to better understand why he used it there in that comedy, in that bit, in that line of that story that he was telling, then I really don't get the full gist of what he was saying, which actually goes even further back to conversations I've had about how original writings of the ancient wisdom teachings in their original languages had such potency, had such energy. But the moment you translated them into another language, you lost virtually all of that.
You lose a lot.
I mean, going from Hebrew, for example, because I know enough, I don't know a lot, but enough about the Hebrew language and the alphabet, their alphabet. Each of those letters has its own legend, tone and tone and numerical ranking and story, et cetera, et cetera. And then you start putting those letters together ad infinitum. But then when you translate to another language, poof, that's all virtually gone.
I think that's true. And that's the case even when you, for example, say you had a founder of a great movement and then he wants to pass it on to a successor. Well, if the successor, if the person following after did not have, doesn't have his own creative vision, then he's just trying to copy somebody else's and perpetuate. So that's why it's so important when myths are told that they are retold with new potency. So where the myth needs to get a chance to speak in its original form to the creator of the new story. But if that creator of a new story only tries to copy it, all the translation, the potency will be lost.
It strikes me that when this also starts to go into the aspects, as we talked about early on in this program, and when I say that, I'm talking going back to 2007, 2008, when I used to have people who would come on who were professional or their vocation was as a storyteller, and that they had to tell that story the same way with exactly the same words as if they were reading it from a script in order for that story to be true. And that if they did not learn it correctly, and that's what they had to do, they had to learn how to tell these stories the same way every single time. Otherwise, the meaning and the message was lost. You couldn't paraphrase.
If you're not going to do a new version of the story, you better try and capture the exact essence of the version you're telling, of the original version.
And that's why the mythology of Greece in particular, the Greek mythology as we're discussing here, obviously it's been written down. So we have the opportunity to get the stories. But then again, how can we be sure that words have been translated in such a way that what we're getting is? So it's almost as though, why weren't we in our schools taught these different languages? Why weren't we taught Greek and Latin and some of the other languages from
used to be
the world.
Standard.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, too, is that, well, maybe not so funny, that we're becoming increasingly unconscious of the languages beneath the surface. So, for example, when Frankenstein was written, subtitled in modern day Prometheus, there are all kinds of references and nuance in there from Prometheus. Same thing with Paradise Lost. Also, a lot of Prometheus inflections and a lot of influence on the figures of Adam and Satan. And to an audience that's familiar with Prometheus, it's a much richer read.
Yeah.
And I would say now we're seeing pushes in culture for people to not go to college, for people to for it to be more expensive for liberal arts education than it is for the sciences, all these kinds of things that actually take away or discourage the development of a film familiarity with cultural memory, because these are not just old stories; they are cultural memory. They are part of the tradition. They're part of the way through which we can know ourselves. And know our history and embed ourselves in an ongoing narrative of human exploration.
It also brings to mind the phrase I've heard that as long, and I heard it yesterday and it was quoted so well in this movie, and I'm going to paraphrase obviously, that as long as there is someone still alive who remembers you, you are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo, as long as there is someone still alive who remembers the Greek gods and the stories, then they are still alive.
Yeah, I think that's true. And but the more people that remember it, the more alive it is.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, in numbers, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
It's exponential. But the point being that these individuals,
mm-hmm.
be they real or made up, and again, as we've discussed earlier on in the program here, mythology isn't just a bunch of made-up stories. There is
mm-hmm.
some truth. We don't know what is and isn't true, but something there is true. And I just think it's very interesting that if more people understood that, it's like me going to the newest Star Trek movie, whatever
mm-hmm.
it may be,
mm-hmm.
and I hear a line, and I'm the only one in the theater amongst the hundreds of people that are in there that laughs.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember the stories of the original series
yeah.
from where this line comes from.
Yeah, totally.
Damn it, Jim. I'm a doctor.
And the funny reciprocate, like with the moment where he's – now, it's absolutely incredible to get me to cry over hands against windows, because that's a pretty cliche thing to see two hands touching through windows.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful reversal of the original movie with the two characters' hands on the windows. And I'll
yeah.
give more detail than that in case people haven't seen the wonderful movie. But there's J.R.R. Tolkien has a wonderful theory on how stories come into being. And it's called the Cauldron of Stories. And the idea is that the creator of a story has all kinds of stuff in their imagination. Their imagination is almost like a cauldron. You know, say I'm writing a story. I know my own life. I know the lives of people around me. I know whatever classical stories I was taught. Say I'm writing a story in from England in the 11th century. Then I know. Then the stories I have access to are the local folkloric stories, the Christian stories. There may be some memory of Roman occupation and some classic stories. These are all stories that are there and present in the imagination of a profound creative individual. And you can anticipate that whatever they write, they'll be writing from their imagination, unless they're trying to specifically pattern, you know, their story off of a specific singular other story. It's going to be a conglomerate, a congealing, a beautiful imaginal confluence of whatever other stories are in their mind. And so a myth may come from the same thing. There may be rituals. There may be a story of a real guy where this happened, but it's a story that so many of us share that it's almost even more than just a story of one guy. Stories can become numinous in a lot of ways, and by the time it's a myth, I feel like a lot of things have probably been combined.
I have to interject here that some of the vocabulary that you have used during this broadcast, I understand. Some of it, but I don't. But I like that fact, because you have gleaned from the halls of education wherever you've gone this vocabulary. And some of our listeners may not have understood some of the words that you've used, which is fine. Look them up. if it's that important to me, I'll look them up too. But there's something there in the context of what you've shared with us about stories and the cauldron of stories that is so relevant to what we're talking about, that it goes to even the heart of what this program is about, of giving people choices and knowledge of those choices.
Mm-hmm.
There are choices that I don't even know about that I could pursue, that I've never thought of before,
mm-hmm.
until I go out there and find them. What was it? The phrase that whenever it was that you were to go off to college, or or even as a kid in school, they'd tell you go to the library and read a book and broaden your horizons. Why is
broaden
that,
your horizons?
Why is that such a bad thing today? In terms of, unless it's given to me by the system, I'm not going to pursue it.
That's a really important thing to talk about. Actually, Carl Jung had some response to that. He says that when there's not like a go-to cultural god or a go-to cultural answer, a place to get answers, as there was, say, in European Christianity or Enlightenment science. People turned to science for solid answers in the Enlightenment. People turned to Christianity for solid answers in the medieval period, whether they were solid or not. And nowadays, our culture doesn't have such a place to turn to for solid answers. And because of that, we have to default in various ways to various things. I think, for one, we're confronted with a nihilism because we don't have a solid foundation to work with. But also, I think that when you're not making some god or some science the ultimate, numinous, important foundation for you, then you're going to find something else to put there. And one of the things that gets put there is the self, for one. If nothing else is important for my decision-making process, shoot, I'm going to do what makes me happy. That's one way. Or also, if there's not some fundamental, foundational truth I can trust, I'm going to go with what I think everybody else thinks. And so you get this almost – the culture itself becomes a deity to trust.
Yeah.
The common sense – I'm going to trust common sense on the collective. Now, what's really dangerous about that is that there are a lot of people spending a lot of money on convincing the collective what is the collective. And so there's something ingenuine about trusting the collective for truth at this point in time.
2 points on that. Number one, when I was a kid growing up in the 70s, listening to music on the radio, I was – and then I get involved in radio in the late 70s. But I was critical of the radio music stations because they would only play one, maybe two songs from an album by a particular artist. And it's like, well, that's not enough. I want to hear some of the other tracks so that I know whether I really like this guy or gal or not, or group. And number two is I was talking with someone just the other day about this. The statistic that comes out every week, usually on a Sunday or a Monday, usually Monday, about the box office receipts for movies. Mm-hmm. And they tell you how much money it made. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't tell you how many people went to see it.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have brought in $3 million and three people saw it.
Yeah.
Because the tickets are so expensive. It's like, so I'm sitting here going, of what relevance is your dollar figure to me? It doesn't tell me how many people saw it. Plus the fact that with critics, if they don't like it, I usually do, and vice versa.
Uh-huh.
If they liked it, I probably don't like it. So that to me is sort of that collective, that whole collective thing that they spend lots of money doing. Before we wrap up our program, and we are running out of time here, unfortunately, my final few questions for you, as I often do to all of my guests. First of all, who is Will Lynn?
I'm the oldest of five sons, born in Birmingham, Alabama, moved to Ohio, lived in Michigan, Tennessee, South Carolina, Florida, and now California. And I'm one of those people that wakes up and gets obsessed with my work and does it all day, every day, with the mythic and academic and creative stuff. And all day, every day, all week, every week. And I am very interested in helping other people to see that mythology and the symbolic way of thinking is a logical way of thinking as well, just like logic that we know and math that we know. And that by adding the symbolic logic, the way of thinking that comes with the symbolic mode, as a complement to logic as we know it and math and science and empiricism as we know it, allows for a whole-brained approach to whatever questions you're engaging. And so I'm very interested in supporting some of the initiatives of places like Pacifica and their outreach to try and make that type of influence.
I could sit here and talk with you for hours on the whole aspect of logic and how it's missing from our society in particular. Things are done for reasons that are beyond my comprehension because they don't make any logical sense.
Mm-hmm.
you're not thinking ahead. You're not using the foresight
to
think, okay, if I do this, what will happen? Down the road, what will happen? And I realize that when the automobile was invented, there was no thought of this because it was a machine that was going to get you from place to place. And it was a novelty at first, and then it became a necessity, just like the cell phone was a novelty and has become a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no thought down the road of how is this going to affect me. I think more people are starting to do that, maybe. If they have the capacity, if they haven't, if their electromagnetic devices haven't,
you know, what's the next asbestos? That's the question. What is the next asbestos?
Exactly. That's it. Yeah, and it also goes to the question that I've often put forth to people when we talk about, well, everything is, as Einstein said, everything is energy. Well, if everything is energy, then what difference does it make? If we're all going back to energy, then what difference does it make? What you eat or drink, or for that matter, do anything, because it's all going to go back to energy anyway. So, big deal.
I feel the way I feel about that is that energy, even though it's not substance, fits within our way of thinking of like what is the substance this stuff comes from.
Exactly.
And then in addition to substance is pattern. And so for me, one of the struggles that science has with meaning is it's so focused on substance. And meaning, I think, comes in pattern and relationships. And so I guess that's where things get important and meaningful to me is how the energy relates.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now, besides getting your PhD?
Well, I would like to set myself free from my obsession with this thesis thought that I've had for so long by finally finishing it and getting it in print. That would be a huge step forward. I'd also like to go into teaching. I'm very interested in teaching. And since you asked, I'll be forthcoming. My real fantasy is to write creatively. Because I believe that the most influential, I believe stories are more influential than virtually anything. It occurred to me when I was 17 that more people have probably read Kafka than Kant, even though Kant's one of the greatest philosophers ever. And it occurred to me that Tolkien is known more for his stories than for his fiction. Mm-hmm. And I realize if you want to make a real big impact, it's through the creative arts. Other stuff just doesn't make it to the surface of the collective in the same way. And I've always been interested in letting my imagination go crazy with all this mythological and philosophical content.
Cool. How powerful are we as human beings?
As powerful as we believe we are. and unless we believe we're powerful, then we're probably not very powerful.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program and sharing with us Prometheus, which, as you've sort of expressed, is sort of the antithesis of Tell Me Your Story, seeking new paradigms for a new world. And hopefully in the process, we can certainly make it an even better world than it is today.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.